Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, President Biden's nominee to the Supreme Court, sat for her second day of confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. All 22 senators on the panel were given 30 minutes of time to question the nominee. Today's proceedings began with Judiciary Chair Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, giving Judge Jackson an opportunity to preempt Republicans' criticism of her record, including the contention that she was lenient on defendants in child porn cases.
Let me address another issue that came up yesterday in the opening phase of this nomination hearing, and it's the issue involving child pornography. I want to turn to that issue because it was raised multiple times, primarily by the senator from Missouri, and he was questioning your sentencing record in child pornography cases that do not involve the production of pornographic material. They're known as non-production cases. I wanted to put some context here. The senator from Missouri has, in his tweets, said of your position on this issue, Judge Jackson has a pattern of letting child porn offenders off the hook for their appalling crimes, both as a judge and a policymaker. She's been advocating it since law school. This goes beyond soft on crime, the senator said. I'm concerned this is a record that endangers our children. I thought about his charges as I watched you and your family listening carefully yesterday and what impact it might have had on you personally to know that your daughters, husband, parents, family, and friends were hearing the charges that your implementation of this law, sentencing, endangered children. Could you tell us what was going through your mind at that point?
Thank you, Senator. As a mother and a judge who has had to deal with these cases, I was thinking that nothing could be further from the truth. These are some of the most difficult cases that a judge has to deal with because we're talking about pictures of sex abuse of children. We're talking about graphic descriptions that judges have to read and consider when they decide how to sentence in these cases. And there's a statute that tells judges what they're supposed to do. Congress has decided what it is that a judge has to do in this and any other case when they sentence. And that statute doesn't say, look only at the guidelines and stop. The statute doesn't say impose the highest possible penalty for this sickening and egregious crime. The statute says calculate the guidelines, but also look at various aspects of this offense and impose a sentence that is, quote, sufficient but not greater than necessary to promote the purposes of punishment. And in every case, when I am dealing with something like this, it is important to me to make sure that the children's perspective, the children's voices, are represented in my sentencings. And what that means is that for every defendant who comes before me and who suggests, as they often do, that they're just a looker, that these crimes don't really matter, they've collected these things on the internet, and it's fine, I tell them about the victim statements that have come in to me as a judge. I tell them about the adults who are former child sex abuse victims who tell me that they will never have a normal adult relationship because of this abuse. I tell them about the ones who say, I went into prostitution, I fell into drugs because I was trying to suppress the hurt that was done to me as an infant. And the one that was the most telling to me that I describe at almost every one of these sentencings when I look in the eyes of a defendant who is weeping because I'm giving him a significant sentence. What I say to him is, do you know that there is someone who has written to me and who has told me that she has developed agoraphobia? She cannot leave her house because she thinks that everyone she meets will have seen her, will have seen her pictures on the internet. They're out there forever. At the most vulnerable time of her life, and so she's paralyzed. I tell that story to every child porn defendant as a part of my sentencings so that they understand what they have done. I say to them that there's only a market for this kind of material because there are lookers, that you are contributing to child sex abuse. And then I impose a significant sentence and all of the additional restraints that are available in the law. These people are looking at 20, 30, 40 years of supervision. They can't use their computers in a normal way for decades. I am imposing all of those constraints because I understand how significant, how damaging, how horrible this crime is.
Republican Senator Josh Hawley, the junior senator from Missouri, who forecasted in his line of questioning with tweets last week alleging that Judge Jackson had a, quote, alarming pattern on sex offenders, had this to say on day two of the confirmation hearing.
The seven cases, child pornography cases, in which you had discretion, they came before you, you had discretion to sentence one way or another in these seven cases. Not every case, of course, do you have discretion. Sometimes the law requires you to impose a sentence, certain sentence. But in these seven, you had discretion, and in each of these seven, you chose to depart both from the federal guidelines and also from the government's, the prosecutor's recommendation. Senator Lee's asked you a little bit about this. Senator Cruz has asked you about it. He had a chart with the seven cases on it. Before we jump into those, I just want to correct the record on one or two things. Senator Coons suggested that in three cases, Nickerson, Wynn, and Fife, you actually imposed sentences either within the guidelines or at the same level of the prosecution. But in Nickerson, you didn't have any discretion. That was an 11C1C case. The law bound you. And Wynn wasn't a child porn case, and neither was Fife. Just one other quick thing to clarify. As to this comments about the probation office doesn't issue national guidelines, right? I mean, the probation office doesn't issue sentencing guidelines. They're not public. They're not recommended to all judges. The probation office provides advice to judges case by case, usually in private, usually not available to the public. Is that right, Judge?
Not exactly, Senator. The probation office in criminal cases is assigned by the court to work with respect to the evaluation of cases, in every case consistent with Congress's requirements. The probation office prepares a pre-sentence report in which they review all of the statutory factors concerning sentencing. Congress has a statute for sentencing. It requires judges to consider the nature and circumstances of the offense, the history and characteristics of the defendant, the need for the sentence imposed to promote various purposes of punishment. There are many purposes listed in the statute. And the probation office is the arm of the court that does factual investigations in every criminal case, unless there are certain cases in which you can waive it. But the background is the probation office's assessment of the facts related to a particular sentence and a particular crime. And the probation office's report, when a court sentences, actually, in most cases, becomes the findings of fact of the court. And so the probation office appears just like the prosecution and the defense. The probation office has written a report, and they make a recommendation to the court based on their independent analysis related to the facts of a particular crime and defendant and sentence.
Understood. So they give the court counsel, understood. However, they don't issue guidelines. They're not uniform. It is by its very nature a case-by-case inquiry, as you said. The report goes to the judge. As I understand it, the pre-sentencing report, I'm sorry, the probation reports are not public in all of the cases that we're talking about here. I'd love to see them if they are. But it's not as if there's one set of guidelines that are federal sentencing guidelines and then there's the probation guidelines. The probation office is giving advice to the judge. It varies case by case.
Senator,
but it's not the same.
Sorry, but, I thought you were done.
No, that's all right. Let me ask you about a specific case. I mean, let's talk about, I listed these seven cases in which you had discretion and you did not follow the prosecutor's recommendation or the sentencing guidelines. But let's just talk about one of them because we've talked about some of them as a group. Let's talk about United States versus Hawkins. I think that's one you probably remember from 2013. The defendant there was Wesley Hawkins. He was 18 years old at the time. He uploaded five video files of child pornography from his computer to YouTube. This is how the police got onto him. He then uploaded another 36 depictions of child porn and other lewd photos of children to his iCloud account. When the police executed a search on his apartment on the premises, they found 17 videos on his laptop and 16 images of child pornography, all of them very graphic, some of them involving very young children. 17 videos in particular. This is from the government's sentencing memorandum in this case. Just so we understand the facts, here are some of the videos that the government charged and they recovered. There was a 24 minute, 6 second video depicting a 12-year-old male committing a sexual act. I'm not gonna read exactly what it was. There was a 1 minute and 57 second video depicting an 8-year-old committing a sexual act. There was an 11 minute and 47 second video depicting an 11-year-old committing a sexual act and being raped by an adult male. There was a 15-minute and 19-second video depicting two 11-year-olds committing sexual acts. There was a 7-minute and 51-second video depicting a 12-year-old committing a sexual act. So, as the government said in this case, and I'm quoting now from the transcript of the sentencing hearing, 17 videos is a lot. And some of the videos, including the ones that are described in the statement of the offense, and I've just related some of them, are very lengthy and include numerous images, numerous views, sometimes collages, sometimes multiple victims. You see the act in progress. The government goes on to describe some of these as sadomasochistic images. So this is a tough case. This is one of those tough cases you were referencing earlier. You talked about it this morning. You said these cases are terrible. This is one of them. This is terrible stuff. This is not a good guy who's doing this stuff. Guidelines recommendation in the case was 97 to 121 months. So if I'm doing my math right, that's up to 10 years. And in this case, the guidelines recommendation was essentially written by Congress because in the PROTECT Act of 2003, Congress specified what they wanted the range to be in these kind of cases. And Congress also specified what they wanted the mandatory minimums to be. I know you remember the PROTECT Act because you've talked about it. You've given lectures on it. And it was enacted, as I said, in 2003. It was 84-0 was the vote here in the Senate. The concern, the reason the PROTECT Act was put into place is the Senate was concerned over lenient sentences by judges in child porn cases, which is what you described. You said about it, there was an increasing perception on Capitol Hill and within DOJ that liberal judges were to blame for the downward pressure on federal sentences and that legislation was necessary to rein them in. That's you in 2011 describing this law. So Congress has set the guidelines here, 84-0 in the Senate. I noticed the chairman voted for it, as did a number of other members of this committee. So the Congress sets the range. Essentially, it's 97 months up to 10 years. Now, the prosecutor in this case, this is in D.C., of course. You're on the federal district court. The prosecutor in this case, it's a liberal administration, I think it's fair to say. This is in the state of Texas. I see my colleague from Texas next to me here. The prosecutor in this case, nevertheless, still asked for 2 full years in prison. You gave the defendant 3 months. Guidelines called for 10 years. Prosecutor wanted at least 2. You gave him 3 months. And when you did, you made a number of arguments and statements in the record, and I'd like to go through some of them because I've read them all. And the first argument you made was that the federal guidelines that punished child porn offenders, the ones that Congress wrote, were, and I'm quoting you now, are in many ways outdated. That's your quote. And you went on to say about why you thought they were outdated. I'm going to quote you again. You say, and I quote, "I don't feel that it's appropriate to increase the penalty on the basis of the number of images or prepubescent victims," meaning little kids, "as the guidelines require, because these circumstances exist in many cases, if not most, and don't signal an especially heinous or egregious child pornography offense," end quote. I just want to ask you about that because I just have to tell you I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around it. We're talking about 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds and 11-year-olds and 12-year-olds. He's got images of these. The government said added up to over 600 images. Gobs of video footage of these children. But you say this does not signal a heinous or egregious child pornography offense. Help me understand that. What word would you use if it's not heinous or egregious? How would you describe it?
Thank you, Senator, for letting me address the concern that you've put forward based on the record that you've reviewed. As a judge who is a mom and has been tasked with the responsibility of actually reviewing the evidence that you would not describe in polite company, the evidence that you are pointing to, discussing, addressing in this context is evidence that I have seen in my role as a judge. And it is heinous. It is egregious. What a judge has to do is determine how to sentence defendants proportionately consistent with the elements that the statutes include, with the requirements that Congress has set forward. Unwarranted sentencing disparities is something that the Sentencing Commission has been focused on for a long time in regard to child pornography offenses. All of the offenses are horrible. All of the offenses are egregious. But the guidelines, as you pointed out, are being departed from even with respect to the government's recommendation. The government, in this case and in others, has asked for a sentence that is substantially less than the guideline penalty. And so what I was discussing was that phenomenon, that the guidelines in this area are not doing the work of differentiating defendants, as the government itself indicated in this very case. And so that's what I was talking about, but I want to assure you, Senator, that I take these cases very seriously, that these cases include the notion by many defendants that the folks at issue, that the defendants themselves are collecting these images on the internet. They're terrible things that have happened, but they're not involved, say the defendants. They're not focused on, you know, what is actually happening to the children. And so part of my sentencing was about redirecting the defendant's attention. It's not just about how much time a person spends in prison. It's about understanding the harm of this behavior. It's about all of the other kinds of restraints that sex offenders are ordered rightly to live under at the end of the day. The sentences in these cases include not only prison time, but restraints on computer use, sometimes for decades, restraints on ability to go near children, sometimes for decades. All of these things judges consider in order to affect what Congress has required, which is a sentence that is sufficient but not greater than necessary to promote the purposes of punishment.
Yeah, well, let me just ask you about that last point, because you've said this a couple of times now, the sentences that Congress require. Congress wanted the guidelines to be mandatory. Congress wrote the guidelines in this case. They wanted them to be mandatory. They gave the courts factors to consider to choose between the sentencing range. Congress wanted you to choose between 97 and 121 months. That's what Congress wanted. The Supreme Court in Booker said that the sentencing guidelines would be discretionary, so the Supreme Court gave you the discretion. But if we're talking about what Congress has wanted, Congress wanted them to be mandatory. My only point in raising that is just to say that you had discretion in these cases, and you used your discretion to choose the sentences that you did. Let me ask you about some of the things, though, that you said, because you said this morning, and I appreciated it, how you want to direct the defendants. You want to get them to own up to what they've done in these cases. And I thought that was powerful, and I thought it was right. But let me just ask you about what you said to this defendant. You said to this defendant, through whom you sentenced to only 3 months in prison, that your collection, I'm quoting you, your collection at the time that you were caught was not actually as large as it seems. The government felt the need to respond to you on the record. They said the government doesn't believe that it's appropriate to just disregard the number of images, that the number of images can be appropriate, and indeed in this case, the defendant has amassed an extremely large collection of child pornography. But you disregarded that. You also told the defendant, you said this seems to be a case where you were fascinated by sexual images involving what were essentially your peers. And then you went on to say the defendant was merely trying to satisfy his curiosity. Curiosity is your word. One more thing on this, same idea. You said you were viewing, this is you to the defendant, you were viewing sex acts between children who were not much younger than you. And this whole discussion is about why you're only giving him 3 months. Judge, he was 18. These kids are 8. I don't see in what sense they're peers. I've got a 9-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 16-month-old at home, and I live in fear that they will be exposed to, let alone exploited, in this kind of material. I don't understand you saying to him that they're peers and that, therefore, you were viewing sex acts between children who are not much younger than you, and that that's somehow a reason to only give him 3 months. Help me understand this.
Senator, I don't have the record of that entire case in front of me. What I recall with respect to that case is that unlike the many other child pornography offenders that I had seen as a judge and that I was aware of in my work on the Sentencing Commission, this particular defendant had just graduated from high school. And some of, perhaps not all when you were looking at the records, but some of the materials that he was looking at were older teenagers, were older victims. And the point, Senator, is that you said before the probation office is making recommendations and they do so on a case-by-case basis. That is what Congress requires. This is not done at the level of.
But you had discretion, Judge. You admit that, right? I just want to be clear.
Senator, sentencing is a discretionary act of a judge, but it's not a numbers game. It's not. I understand that Congress wanted the guidelines to be mandatory. The Supreme Court in 2005 determined that they couldn't be, in an opinion by Justice Scalia. Determined that they couldn't be, and Congress since then has not come back to amend them or to change them or to make them mandatory again. And so there is discretion at sentencing, and when you look at the sentencing statutes, Congress has given the judges not only the discretion to make the decision, but required judges to do so on an individualized basis, taking into account not only the guidelines, but also various factors, including the age of the defendant, the circumstances of the defendant, the terrible nature of the crime, the harm to the victims, all of these factors are taken into account, and the probation office assists the court in determining what sentence is sufficient but not greater than necessary. And I appreciate, Senator, that you have looked at these from the standpoint of statistics, that you're questioning whether or not I take them seriously or I have some reason to handle them in either a different way than my peers or a different way than other cases. And I assure you that I do not. That if you were to look at the greater body of not only my more than 100 sentences, but also the sentences of other judges in my district and nationwide, you would see a very similar exercise of attempting to do what it is that judges do, attempting to take into account all of the relevant factors and do justice individually in each case.
Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson was asked repeatedly on day two of her confirmation hearing about her work as a lawyer advocating for due process rights of suspected terrorists detained at the military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Here's Senator Lindsey Graham at the start of the day. Following the senator's exchange with the nominee, he also had a heated exchange with Judiciary Chair Senator Dick Durbin.
Let's talk about Gitmo. Being a public defender, did you consider that rewarding?
Senator, yes, I did, because public service is very important to me. It is an important family value. It is something that now I've dedicated my career to.
Yes. And do you think it's important to the system that everybody be represented?
Absolutely. It's a core constitutional value.
You'll get no complaint from me. That was my job in the Air Force. I was an area defense counsel. I represented anybody that came in the door, whether I liked them or not. I did my best. Is that what you did?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Now, so the American people deserve a system where everybody's represented, where you like them or not, and anybody takes up that cause, no problem with me. You're just doing your job, and I think you make our country stronger. But there's the other side of the story that never gets mentioned when I talk about Gitmo. The American people deserve a system that can keep terrorists off the battlefield. They deserve a system that understands the difference between being at war and a crime. Do you consider 9/11, you said, a terrible, tragic event? Would you consider it an act of war?
Yes, Senator.
Okay, I would too. I think it was an act of war by Al-Qaeda and associated groups against the people of the United States. So as you rightfully are proud of your service as a public defender, and you represented Gitmo detainees, which is part of our system, I want you to understand and the nation to understand what's been happening at Gitmo. What's the recidivism rate at Gitmo?
Senator, I'm not aware.
It's 31%. How does that strike you? Is that high, low, about right?
I don't know how it strikes me overall.
You know how it strikes me? It strikes me as terrible.
Yes, that's what I was going to say.
Okay, good. We found common ground. Of the 229 detainees released from Gitmo, 729 released, 229 have gone back to the fight. Here's some of the notables. Former Gitmo detainee Zakir was named the interim defense minister of Afghanistan. I don't know exactly what his job is today, but during the transition, they made him the defense minister and he was in Gitmo. Of the five men we released from Gitmo as part of a prisoner swap for Sergeant Bergdale, here's where they're at. Mohammed Fazal was appointed deputy minister of defense. Noor was appointed acting minister of borders and tribal affairs. Waziki was appointed as acting intelligence director. Kerr, again, acting minister of information, culture, defense. Omar was appointed as the new governor of the southeastern province of Coast. These were five people that we had in our control that are now helping the Taliban run the country. Would you say that our system in terms of releasing people needs to be re-looked at?
Senator, what I'd say is that that's not a job for the courts in this way. That
as an American, does that bother you?
Well, obviously, Senator, any repeated criminal behavior or repeated attacks, acts of war, bother me as an American.
Well, it bothers me. While I will not hold it against you, nor should I, the fact that you represent Gitmo detainees, I think it's time to look at this system new, folks. When 31% of the people are going back to fight to kill Americans and now running the Taliban government, we have gone wrong somewhere. Are we still at war?
So the AUMF, the authorization for military force, is still in effect. Congress has authorized the use of force against people in this way.
But do you personally believe that Al-Qaeda, ISIS-type groups are still at war with us?
I think yes. I mean, I think we...
So we're still in a state of war with certain elements of radical Islam to this very day?
I believe that's documented, yes.
Okay. Now, what's the process to determine whether one's an enemy combatant under our law?
Well, I believe that the executive branch makes an assessment of whether or not someone is taking up arms against the United States somewhere in the world related to all of this.
Okay. So it's an executive branch function to determine whether or not this person qualifies as an enemy combatant.
Well, I believe that they make a
determination. Under current law.
Under current law, I believe that determination is made by the executive branch and the person is put into, is detained. And then the question becomes whether they are able to bring some sort of legal challenge to that
determination. They have a habeas right.
Yes.
Okay. So the law is that the executive branch determines if you're an enemy combatant. And under our law, you can appeal that decision to a federal court through habeas. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct.
Okay. Is it your view that we can hold enemy combatants as long as they're a threat to the United States?
I believe that's what the Supreme Court has determined.
Okay. Did you argue that that should not be the case before in an amicus brief?
I'm trying to think. I had two amicus briefs that I worked on, or three technically, but two different cases.
Well, we'll have another visit tomorrow.
So yes.
Go back and check.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure that in your brief you argued that the executive branch should not have the ability to hold an enemy combatant indefinitely. You need to try them through some process or release them.
Yes, Senator. As you were talking, my clients, the Cato Institute, the Rutherford Institute, mm-hmm. and the Constitution Project made that argument and asked me to draft their brief.
Yes. Well, do you agree with that argument?
Senator, my responsibility was to make my clients' arguments, and as a nominee to the Supreme Court, that's the kind of issue. The Supreme Court did not address that issue. They, in fact... the case became moot.
Did you organize an effort to get 20 judges to file a brief to the Supreme Court on this issue?
Not on that issue, no, Senator.
On another issue?
Yes, Senator.
Okay. Did you actively go out and recruit 20 judges to help you file a brief on another issue regarding law of war detention?
Not technically.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that I was at Morrison & Foerster, which was my law firm, in the Supreme Court and appellate group. One of the partners at Morrison & Foerster was a former federal judge who wanted to make this argument and who said, I have former federal judges who are friends of mine who would like to join with me to make this argument. So I worked with her, the partner at my firm, who was a former federal judge, to make...
So it was her idea to get former judges to write this,
yes.
Not yours?
Yes.
And you just helped in the implementation of that idea?
So, Senator, as a member of the Supreme Court and appellate group in a law firm, that is the practice.
Right. Now I'm asking...
Amicus practice, yes.
It wasn't your idea, it was somebody else.
Yes.
Okay. Now, there are people still held at Gitmo today. Do you understand that?
Yes.
Okay. What system is in place regarding their future?
I am not aware of the system right now. I'm not sure exactly what you mean.
Let me tell you what it is.
Yes.
There's a periodic review process made up of an interagency where they go through the files of these folks and they determine whether or not they still present a threat to the United States or the world at large. And I think it's 6 months, maybe a year. But that goes on at least on an annual basis. And if there's a determination that this person still represents a threat to the United States, they're continued to be confined. That's the way the system works. Are you okay with that?
As a policy matter, Senator, I'm not speaking to my views. That's my understanding is that the periodic review system is an executive branch determination of whether or not they're going to continue to hold people that they...
Does that make sense to you as a way to deal with these detainees?
Senator, I'm not in a position to speak to the policy or the discretion of the executive branch regarding how they're going to handle detainees.
The reason I mention it is because in one of the briefs, you argued that the executive branch doesn't have that option. That if you had had your way, the executive branch could not do periodic reviews about the danger the detainee presents to the United States, they would have to make a decision of trying them or releasing them. Is that not accurate?
Respectfully, Senator, it was not my argument. Really? I was filing an amicus brief on behalf of clients, including the Rutherford Institute, the Cato Institute, and the Constitution Project, who...
When you sign on to a brief, does it not become your argument?
It does not, Senator. If you are an attorney and you are representing a client in amicus...
Is that your position when you were in private practice? I mean, you sign on to this brief making this argument, but you say it's not your position. I mean, why would you do that if it's not your position? Why would you take a client that has a position like that? Now, this is voluntary. Nobody's making you do this.
Oh, Senator, I would refer you to the same sorts of statements that Chief Justice Roberts made when he came before the committee, which is that lawyers represent clients.
I'm not holding the client's views against you. The people you represent at Gitmo, they deserve representation. But this is a amicus brief where you and other people try to persuade the court to change policy. The policy I described is a periodic review. If the court had taken the position argued in the brief that you signed upon, we'd have to release these people or try them, and some of them, the evidence we can't disclose because it's classified, you're putting America in an untenable position. This is not the way you fight a war. If you tried to do this in World War II, they'd run you out of town. We hold enemy combatants as long as they're a threat. There's no magic passage of time that you got to let them go. So my question is very simple. Do you support the idea, did you support then the idea that indefinite detention of an enemy combatant is unlawful?
Respectfully, Senator, when you are an attorney and you have clients who come to you, whether they pay or not, you represent their positions before the court.
I'm sure everybody at Gitmo wants out. No, I got that. This is an amicus brief, and I just don't understand what you're saying, quite frankly. I'm not holding against you because you represented a legal position I disagree with. I mean, that happens all the time. I'm just trying to understand what made you join this cause. And you say somebody hired you, but did you feel okay in adopting that cause? I mean, when you signed on to the brief, were you not advocating that position to the court?
Senator, as a judge now, in order to determine the lawfulness or unlawfulness of any particular issue, I need to receive briefs and information making positions on all sides.
I got what a judge is all about. Listen, I'm not asking you to decide the case in front of me right here. I'm asking me to explain a position you took as a lawyer regarding the law of war, and I am beyond confused. I know what you said in your brief. Whether I agree with it or not, it's not the point. I just want you to understand that it's important for all of us to know where you were coming from. If that brief had been accepted by the court, it would be impossible for us to fight this war. Because there's some people going to die in jail in Gitmo and never go to trial for a lot of good reasons. Because the evidence against them is so sensitive, we can't disclose it to the public. That we're not charging them with a crime. What we're doing is saying that you engaged in hostile activities against the United States, that you are an enemy combatant under our law, and you will never be released as long as you're a danger until the war is over or you're no longer a danger. That's the difference between fighting a crime and a war. Did you ever accuse in one of your habeas petitions the government of acting as war criminals for holding the detainees? The holding of the detainees by our government, that we were acting as war criminals.
Senator, I don't remember that accusation, but I will say that...
Do you believe that's true, that America was acting as war criminals in holding these detainees?
Senator, the Supreme Court held that the executive branch has the authority to detain people who are designated as enemy combatants for the duration of the hostilities. And what I was doing in the context of the habeas petitions at this very early stage in the process was making allegations to preserve issues on behalf of my clients. A habeas petition is like a complaint that lawyers make allegations.
You know, I've been a lawyer too, but I don't think it's necessary to call the government a war criminal in pursuing charges against a terrorist. I just think that's too far. I don't know why he chose those words. That's just too far. But we are where we are.
On the issue of Guantanamo, there are currently 39 Guantanamo detainees remaining. The annual budget for Guantanamo is $540 million per year, which means each of these detainees is being held at the expense of $12 or $13 million per year. If they would be incarcerated at Florence, Colorado, the supermax prison, federal prison, the amount would be dramatically, dramatically less. Since 9/11, nearly 1,000 convicted in the United States on terrorism charges. Since 2009, with the beginning of the Obama administration, the recidivism rate of Guantanamo detainees released is 5%.
Mr. Chairman, according to the Department, Director of National Intelligence, is 31%. Somebody is wrong here. If you're going to talk about what I said, I'm going to respond to what you said. If we close Gitmo and move them to Colorado, do you support indefinite detention under the law of war for these detainees?
I would just say I'm giving the facts. And
the answer is no.
I want to make sure that it's clear. The 31% you referred to goes back to the year 2009.
What does it matter when it goes back to? We had them and they got loose and they started killing people.
Well, I could just say that...
If you're one of the people killed in 2005, does it matter to you when we released them?
Suggest that a president of your own party released them in
I'm suggesting the system has failed miserably, and advocates to change this system, like she was advocating, would destroy our ability to protect this country. We're at war. We're not fighting a crime. This is not some passage of time event. As long as they're dangerous, I hope they all die in jail if they're going to go back and kill Americans. It won't bother me one bit if 39 of them die in prison. That's a better outcome than letting them go. And if it costs $500 million to keep them in jail, keep them in jail, because they're going to go back to the fight. Look at the friggin' Afghan government. It's made up of former detainees at Gitmo. This whole thing by the left about this war ain't working.
Let me also note that Larry Thompson, who served as Deputy Attorney General under President George W. Bush, Orrin Kerr, Special Counsel, Viet Dinh, who served as Assistant Attorney General for Legal Policy in the George W. Bush administration, John Bellinger, and former D.C. Circuit Judge, Solicitor General, and Independent Counsel Ken Starr were also prominent conservative lawyers signing a letter defending attorneys who represented Guantanamo Bay detainees. I don't believe that we should associate that activity as being inconsistent with our constitutional values.
Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, also asked the judge about her work as a public defender of Gitmo detainees.
I don't know you well, but I've been impressed by our interaction, and you've been gracious and charming. Why in the world would you call Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and George W. Bush war criminals in a legal filing? It seems so out of character for you.
Senator, you may have been are you talking about briefs that I, or habeas petitions that I filed?
Talking about when you were representing a member of the Taliban and the Department of Defense identified him as an intelligence officer for the Taliban, and you referred to the Secretary of Defense and the sitting President of the United States as war criminals. Why would you do something like that? It seems so out of character.
Well, Senator, I don't remember that particular reference, and I was representing my clients and making arguments. I'd have to take a look at what you meant. I did not intend to disparage the President or the Secretary of Defense.
Well, being a war criminal has huge ramifications. You could be subject to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court and hauled before that international tribunal and tried for war crimes. So it's not a casual comment, I would suggest. Thank you.
Following a break for lunch, Senator Judiciary Chair Dick Durbin refuted the claim that Judge Jackson referred to former President George W. Bush and former Defense Secretary Rumsfeld as war criminals.
I would like to make a statement in terms of some research that was undertaken during the break. Judge Jackson, earlier Senator Cornyn said that you had called former President George W. Bush and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld a, quote, war criminal, unquote. I noticed a little surprise in your reaction, and I was surprised by the allegation. During your service as a public defender, you filed several habeas petitions against the United States, naming former President Bush and former Secretary Rumsfeld in their official capacities. You were advocating on behalf of individuals who argued they were civilians, wrongly classified as enemy combatants of the United States, and your filing was part of your professional responsibility to zealously advocate for your clients. In those petitions, the individuals raised more than a dozen claims for relief, one of which was an allegation that the government had sanctioned torture against the individuals, which constituted war crimes under the Alien Tort Statute. The Alien Tort Statute allows courts to hear cases for alleged violations of the law of nations or the treaties of the United States. Apparently, this is what Senator Cornyn was referencing. So to be clear, there was no time where you called President Bush or Secretary Rumsfeld a, quote, war criminal, close quote. Did you want
correct,
to respond?
Senator. No, okay. Thank you. That was correct.
Thank you very much.
Later in the hearing, Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz used part of his time to question Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson about her views of critical race theory.
In your questionnaire to this committee, you disclosed that you are similarly on a board, specifically the Board of Trustees for the Georgetown Day School, and that you've been a board member since 2019 and you're currently still a board member. Is that correct?
That is correct.
In regard to the Georgetown Day School, you've publicly said, quote, "Since becoming a member of the GDS community 7 years ago, Patrick and I have witnessed the transformative power of a rigorous progressive education that is dedicated to fostering critical thinking, interdependence, and social justice." When you refer to social justice and the school's mission on social justice, what did you mean by that?
Thank you, Senator, for allowing me to address this issue. Georgetown Day School has a special history that I think is important to understand when you consider my service on that board. The school was founded in 1945 in Washington, D.C., at a time in which, by law, there was racial segregation in this community. Black students were not allowed in the public schools to go to school with white students. Georgetown Day School is a private school that was created when three white families, Jewish families, got together with three black families and said that despite the fact that the law requires us to separate, despite the fact that the law is set up to make sure that black children are not treated the same as everyone else, we are going to form a private school so that our children can go to school together. The idea of equality, justice, is at the core of the Georgetown Day School mission, and it's a private school such that every parent who joins the community does so willingly with an understanding that they are joining a community that is designed to make sure that every child is valued, every child is treated as having inherent worth, and none are discriminated against because of race.
So, Judge Jackson, all of us will agree that no one should be discriminated against because of race. When you just testified a minute ago that you didn't know if critical race theory was taught in K through 12, I will confess I find that statement a little hard to reconcile with the public record, because if you look at the Georgetown Day School's curriculum, it is filled and overflowing with critical race theory. That among the books that are either assigned or recommended, they include Critical Race Theory, an introduction. They include The End of Policing, an advocacy for abolishing police. They include How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram Kendi. They include literally stacks and stacks of books, and I'll tell you two of the ones that were most stunning. They include a book called Anti-Racist Baby by Ibram Kendi. And there are portions of this book that I find really quite remarkable. One portion of the book says, "Babies are taught to be racist or anti-racist. There is no neutrality." Another portion of the book, they recommend to babies confess when being racist. Now, this is a book that is taught at Georgetown Day School to students in pre-K through second grade, so 4 through 7 years old. Do you agree with this book that is being taught with kids that babies are racist?
Senator, I do not believe that any child should be made to feel as though they are racist or though they are not valued or though they are less than, that they are victims, that they are oppressors. I don't believe in any of that. But what I will say is that when you asked me whether or not this was taught in schools, critical race theory, my understanding is that critical race theory as an academic theory is taught in law schools, and to the extent that you were asking the question, I understood you to be addressing public schools. Georgetown Day School, just like the religious school that Justice Barrett was on the board of, is a private school.
Okay, so you agree critical race theory is taught at Georgetown Day School?
I don't know, because the board is not, the board does not control the curriculum. The board does not focus on that. That's not what we do as board members. So I'm actually not sure.
Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, who has voted for 9 Supreme Court nominees, began her questioning with a question she has asked previous nominees.
One of the issues that I often discuss with nominees, particularly to the Supreme Court, is the issue of abortion. I've asked the 3 most recent Supreme Court nominees about this issue, and so I'd like to discuss it a bit with you today. In 2017, I asked Justice Gorsuch about this during his confirmation hearing. I asked him to expand on a comment he had made about his belief that precedent is important because it adds stability to the law. In response, Justice Gorsuch reiterated his belief that precedent is important because, and I quote, once a case is settled, that adds to the determinancy of the law, end quote. He also stated that Roe has been reaffirmed many times. I also spoke with Judge Kavanaugh about this issue in 2018. I asked him whether he believes that Roe was settled wrong, and if so, whether it was correctly settled. Justice Kavanaugh said that Roe, quote, is settled as a precedent of the Supreme Court, end quote. He said that Roe, quote, has been reaffirmed many times over the past 45 years, and most prominently, most importantly, reaffirmed in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, end quote. And he described Casey as having the value of a precedent on precedent, end quote. I most recently spoke about this issue with Justice Barrett in 2020. I asked her whether she agreed with Justice Scalia's view that Roe was wrongly decided. She committed to, quote, obey all the rules of stare decisis, end quote, if faced with the question of whether to overrule Casey. She said she had, quote, no agenda to try to overrule Casey, end quote. So here's the question. Do you agree with Justice Kavanaugh that Roe v. Wade is settled as a precedent? And will you, like Justice Barrett, commit to obey all the rules of stare decisis in cases related to the issue of abortion, end quote?
Thank you, Senator. I do agree with both Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Barrett on this issue. Roe and Casey are the settled law of the Supreme Court concerning the right to terminate a woman's pregnancy. They have established a framework that the court has reaffirmed, and in order to revisit, as Justice Barrett said, the Supreme Court looks at various factors because stare decisis is a very important principle. It provides and establishes predictability, stability. It also serves as a restraint in this way on the exercise of judicial authority, because the court looks at whether or not precedents are relied upon, whether they're workable, in addition to whether or not they're wrong, and other factors as well. So I agree with both of those statements that you read.
Well, let me add one to that, and then we'll move on. I'm particularly interested in the case of Roe v. Wade. Roe was decided by nearly 50 years ago, and it's been reaffirmed over a dozen times since then. So my question is this. Does Roe v. Wade have the status of being a case that is a super precedent, and what other Supreme Court cases do you believe have that status?
Well, Senator, all Supreme Court cases are precedential. They're binding, and their principles and their rulings have to be followed. Roe and Casey, as you say, have been reaffirmed by the court and have been relied upon. And reliance is one of the factors that the court considers when it seeks to revisit, or when it's asked to revisit, revisit a precedent. And in all cases, those the precedents of the Supreme Court would have to be reviewed pursuant to those factors, because stare decisis is very important.
Several senators on the Judiciary Committee asked Judge Jackson to explain her judicial philosophy. Here are questions from the two top senators on the committee, Chair Dick Durbin of Illinois and the ranking member, Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa. Following those senators, you'll also hear from Senator Ben Sasse, Republican of Nebraska.
Judge Jackson, there are two issues that came up repeatedly yesterday from the other side of the aisle that I want to address at the outset. One of them was a question of judicial philosophy. No one questions either your academic law school credentials or your service as clerk and as federal judge. But time and again, you have been asked, what is your judicial philosophy? Does it fit into Scalia's originalism, Kavanaugh's textualism? Is it strict construction? Is it liberal? Is it conservative? Lo and behold, I've discovered the answer. It turns out that during the course of your time as a judge, you have actually had written opinions, 573 to be exact, I think. Maybe I'm off by one or two. And they more or less express your view of the law as the facts are presented to you in each one of those cases. And then some 12,000 pages from the Sentencing Commission, transcripts of deliberations on important issues. For most of us as elected senators, if people asked what's your philosophy, we'd point to our voting record. You have a record when it comes to court decisions. And this committee, for the fourth time, is delving into everything that you've published as a judge and even before. So would you like to comment at the outset of those who are looking for a label, what your position is on judicial philosophy?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Over the course of my almost decade on the bench, I have developed a methodology that I use in order to ensure that I am ruling impartially and that I am adhering to the limits on my judicial authority. I am acutely aware that as a judge in our system, I have limited power, and I am trying in every case to stay in my lane. And so what I do is I essentially follow three steps. The first step is when I get a case, I ensure that I am proceeding from a position of neutrality. This means that, you know, you get a case and it's about something and it's submitted by certain parties. I am clearing my mind of any preconceived notions about how the case might come out. I'm setting aside any personal views. It's very important that judges rule without fear or favor. The second step is once I've cleared the decks, so to speak, in this way, I am able to receive all of the appropriate inputs for the case. That is the party's arguments. They've written briefs. Sometimes we have a hearing. Sometimes we hear from other parties, amici in a case. And then there's the factual record. I am evaluating all of the facts from various perspectives. I think my experience, all of the various experiences that I've had, really helps me at this stage to see the perspectives of all of the parties and to understand their arguments. And then the third step is the interpretation and application of the law to the facts in the case. And this is where I'm really observing the constraints on my judicial authority. There are many constraints in our system, importantly, because judges have limited authority. And so I am, first of all, looking at my jurisdiction. Threshold matter in every federal case is to make sure that you even have the power to hear the case. In evaluating jurisdiction, you're looking at all sorts of things. The text of a jurisdictional provision, for example, precedent related to it. If I can get to the merits of the case, if I have jurisdiction, then I am observing the limits on my authority concerning the question. So if it is a statute, for example, or a provision of the Constitution, I'm looking at the text. The adherence to text is a constraint on my authority. I'm trying to figure out what those words mean as they were intended by the people who wrote them. So at this point, I'm looking at original documents. I am focusing on the original public meaning because I'm constrained to interpret the text. Sometimes that's enough to resolve the issue in terms of the merits. Judges also look at history and practice at the time of the document was created. If it's a statute, I'm looking at Congress's purposes because, again, I am not importing my personal views or policy preferences. The entire exercise is about trying to understand what those who created this policy or this law intended. I'm also looking at precedent, which is another constraint on judicial authority. I am looking at prior cases and trying to understand what other judges have said. As a lower court judge, I'm bound by the precedent. And even in the Supreme Court, if I was fortunate enough to be confirmed, there's stare decisis, which is a binding kind of principle that the justices look at when they're considering precedents. So all of these things come into play in terms of my judicial philosophy.
Another issue which has come up to my surprise, and I've spoken to my Republican colleagues about their fascination with it, is the notion of the composition of the Supreme Court, which euphemistically is referred to as court packing. I have said on the floor, and I will repeat here, there is exactly one living senator who has effectively changed the size of the Supreme Court. That was the Republican leader, Senator McConnell, who shrank the court to 8 seats for nearly a year in 2016 when he blocked President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland. Now, that question on court packing was posed to Amy Coney Barrett, justice in the court, when she appeared before this committee. She was asked about it. She said, and I quote, "could not opine on it." And on many other policy issues, then Judge Barrett said repeatedly she could not share her views, stating, and I quote, "I will not express a view on a matter of public policy, especially one that is politically controversial, because that is inconsistent with the judicial role." I do believe we should have rules and traditions and precedents, but we shouldn't have a separate set of rules for Republican nominees and Democratic nominees. So, Judge Jackson, if a senator were to ask you today about proposals about changing the current size of the Supreme Court, what would your response be?
Senator, I agree with Justice Barrett in her her response to that question when she was asked before this committee. Again, my North Star is the consideration of the proper role of a judge in our constitutional scheme. And in my view, judges should not be speaking to political issues, and certainly not a nominee for a position on the Supreme Court. So I agree with Justice Barrett.
Do the First Amendment free speech protections apply equally to conservative and liberal protesters?
Yes, Senator.
Do you believe the individual right to to keep and bear arms is a fundamental right.
Senator, the Supreme Court has established that the individual right to keep and bear arms is a fundamental right.
Could you tell me how you might go about deciding what a fundamental right is under the Constitution?
Well, Senator, I don't know that I can tell you that in the abstract, in the sort of way that you may have posed the question. There is precedent in the Supreme Court related to various rights that the court has recognized as fundamental. The court has some precedents about the standards for determining whether or not something is fundamental. The court has said that the 14th Amendment substantive due process clause does support some fundamental rights, but only things that are implicit in the ordered concept of liberty or deeply rooted in the history and traditions of this country. They're the kinds of rights that relate to personal, individual autonomy, and they've recognized a few things in that category, and that's the tradition of the court for determining whether something is fundamental in that way.
You've served on the district court for several years and spent 8 months on the D.C. Circuit. During yesterday's opening statement, we heard a lot about the importance of judicial philosophy. In your own words, you've described that, so you don't have to go through that again with me. But if Congress writes a law that does not explicitly allow private parties to sue, do you believe that the federal courts have the authority to create implied causes of action? And I'd like to have you elaborate if you say yes to that.
I would say that as a general matter, no, Senator. I mean, our obligation as judges is not to create policy. And if Congress has enacted a statute that establishes a cause of action or restricts causes of action, then as a general matter, I don't think that courts can impose one. Now, you know, I'm saying generally because there may be circumstances that I'm not thinking of. I know that the Supreme Court has in very narrow circumstances at times discussed implied causes of action, but I think the charge of the judge is to impose the law as written.
There's 115 justices that serve before you if you are approved by the Senate. Is there any of them now or in the past that has a judicial philosophy that most closely resembles your own?
You know, I haven't studied the judicial philosophies of all of the prior justices. I will say that I come to this position, to this moment, as a judge who comes from practice, that I was a trial judge, and my methodology has developed in that context. I don't know how many other justices, other than Justice Sotomayor, have that same perspective, but it informs me with respect to what I understand to be my proper judicial role.
What aspect of your record as a judge do you believe have been the most important for the good of the country?
Well, I think that all of my record is important to some degree because I think it clearly demonstrates that I'm an independent jurist, that I am ruling in every case consistent with the methodology that I've described, that I'm impartial. I don't think that anyone can look at my record and say that it is pointing in one direction or another, that it is supporting one viewpoint or another,
I am doing the work and have done the work for the past 10 years that judges do to rule impartially and to stay within the boundaries of our proper judicial role.
I think it might be helpful for us to understand who you most identify with. And past nominees before this committee have talked about the mold of particular justices they thought they followed in. And so if you had to tell the American people who you're closest to, who is that justice? Or who are those justices?
Well, thank you for the question, Senator. And I must admit that I don't really have a justice that I've molded myself after or that I would. What I have is a record. I have 570-plus cases in which I have employed the methodology that I described and that shows people how I analyze cases. I, in every case, am proceeding neutrally, from a neutral posture. In every case, I describe thoroughly all of the arguments that are made in the case to me as a judge, because I want, in my lengthy opinions, for people to understand the inputs. This, I say, is what I'm considering, because I lay out in very, you know, detailed way everything that people have argued in all of the cases. And then when I'm doing my interpretation, I am focused on the text of any statute or constitutional provision. I am looking as appropriate to the intentions of the people who wrote the words, because I view statutory interpretation, constitutional interpretation, those exercises consistent with my limited authority. I am conscious of not interpreting those texts consistent with what I believe the policy should be or what I think the outcome should be. I am trying in every case that involves that kind of interpretation to assess what it is that the parties who wrote the text intended. And as a result, because my methodology involves these various pieces and because of the way in which I do things, I'm reluctant to establish or to adopt a particular label, because the idea of how you interpret is just one part of the entirety of a judge's responsibility.
Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat of Minnesota, spent some of her time with Judge Jackson to ask about the so-called shadow docket, the Supreme Court's emergency proceedings that allow it to act quickly and without public deliberation.
I want to talk to you about something to me that's a bit the opposite, and that's something that some have termed the shadow docket. And that includes decisions that the court makes on an expedited basis that are usually unsigned and issued without oral argument or full briefing. In the last few years, we've seen the court increasingly deciding cases in this way, often over the dissent of maybe three or four of the justices. Last term, the court granted 20 requests for emergency relief, a historically high number. 10 years ago, in the October term of 2011, the court granted only 6 requests in an entire year. When do you think it's appropriate for the Supreme Court to grant emergency relief, use this docket? When are the circumstances that warrant this? And I think you know these decisions have a profound effect on people's lives. I'll just use one example. Last fall, in a one-paragraph decision, a majority of the court refused to stop the enforcement of a Texas law that severely restricts a woman's access to abortion. In that case, even Chief Justice Roberts objected to the court's decision to let the law take effect, calling the statutory scheme not only unusual but unprecedented. As someone who believes in transparency, could you talk in general about when you think this shadow docket should be used, when emergency relief should be given, and how, if it's overused, it could undermine public confidence in the court?
Thank you, Senator. There's a balance that the court has to consider, and that it insofar as, on the one hand, it has always had an emergency docket, the need for flexibility, the ability to get answers to the parties at issue is something that's important in our system. On the other hand, the court has also considered the interest in allowing issues to percolate, allowing other courts to rule on things before they come to the court. And I am not privy at the moment to the justices' views and why and how they're using the emergency docket in these cases. If I was fortunate enough to be confirmed, I would look at those issues. But it's an interesting and important set of issues.
Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn asked the judge on opinions that rely on the 14th Amendment's due process clause.
You can use substantive due process to justify basically any result.
Well, the court...
Whether it's conservative or liberal, libertarian or conservative, whatever you would like to call. It's just it's a mode of analysis by the court that allows the court to substitute its opinion for the elected representatives of the people. And would you agree?
The court has identified standards for the determination of rights under the 14th Amendment substantive due process.
And who gives them the right to do that? If it's not mentioned in the Constitution, where does the right of the court to substitute its views for that of the elected representatives of the people, where does that come from?
Well, the court has interpreted the 14th Amendment to include this component, the unenumerated right to substantive due process, and the court has said that that the kinds of things that qualify are implicit in the concept of ordered liberty, or deeply rooted in our nation's history and tradition. Those are standards that identify a narrow set of activities.
Well, Judge, in the Obergefell case, Justice Roberts, in his dissent, noted that the court invalidated marriage laws of more than half the states and orders the transformation of a social institution that has formed the basis for a human society for millennia. So that was the basis for the institution of marriage, is the practice for millennia and the recognition that marriage was between a man and a woman. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not arguing the merits or lack of merits of same-sex marriage. I believe the states and the voters can choose what they will, and that's their prerogative, and I think that's legitimate. But when the court overrules the decisions made by the people, as they did in 32 of the 35 states that decided to recognize only traditional marriage between a man and a woman, that is a act of judicial policymaking, is it not?
Senator, the Supreme Court has considered that to be an application of the substantive due process clause of the 14th Amendment.
Right. And it doesn't, the Constitution doesn't mention anything about substance when it talks about due process. The 14th Amendment and the 5th Amendment don't talk about substantive due process. It talks about due process of law. Correct?
Correct.
Well, one of the things that concerns me is here is an example of the courts finding a new fundamental right that is mentioned nowhere in the document of the Constitution, that's the product of simply court-made law that we're all supposed to salute smartly and follow, because nine people who are unelected, who have lifetime tenure, whose salary cannot be reduced while they serve in office, They decide, five of them decide, that this is the way the world should be. What other unenumerated rights do you believe exist? And how could we possibly anticipate what those might be? For example, the Ninth Amendment says, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage other rights retained by the people, which suggests to me that there are other, as yet unidentified, rights out there, and somehow, someday, some court is going to tell us, we've identified an unenumerated right, and we're going to reject the right of the American people to determine what the policies ought to be as regards that right, because we, the nine people sitting on the Supreme Court, have decided we've discovered a new unenumerated right, and it shall be the law of the land, and no legislature can pass any law that conflicts with it. What other unenumerated rights are out there, or can you say?
Senator, I can't say. It's a hypothetical that I'm not in a position to comment on. The rights that the Supreme Court has recognized as substantive due process rights are established in its case law.
On February 25th, President Biden nominated Ketanji Brown Jackson, currently a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, to succeed Justice Stephen Breyer. If confirmed by the full Senate, Jackson would become the 116th justice of the Supreme Court, 110 of those justices men. She would be the first Black woman justice and the fourth woman on the current 9-member court. Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, asked the judge about the impact of her serving.
I joined this committee in January of 1993, and a few months later, we considered the nomination of Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the Supreme Court. Justice Ginsburg's confirmation made her only the second woman to ever serve on the Supreme Court after Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. So we have come a very long way since then, though still not far enough. Women now make up about 35% of active judges on the federal district bench and 37% of active judges on the federal appeals courts. Judge Jackson, if confirmed, you would become the sixth woman to ever serve on the Supreme Court. You would join Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Barrett on the bench. This would be the nearest we have ever come to gender equity on the Supreme Court. There would be four women on a court with nine justices. So I have my own thoughts about why gender balance is important on our nation's courts. But I'd really like you to tell us all, what are your thoughts on what it means for our country to have women serve in meaningful numbers on the federal bench, and in particular, what it would mean to have four women serving on the Supreme Court for the first time in history.
Thank you, Senator. I think it's extremely meaningful. One of the things that having diverse members of the court does is it provides for the opportunity for role models. Since I was nominated to this position, I have received so many notes and letters and photos from little girls around the country who tell me that they are so excited for this opportunity and that they have thought about the law in new ways because I am a woman, because I am a Black woman. All of those things people have said have been really meaningful to them. And we want, I think, as a country, for everyone to believe that they can do things like sit on the Supreme Court. And so having meaningful numbers of women and people of color, I think matters. I also think that it supports public confidence in the judiciary when you have different people, because we have such a diverse society.
Senator Chuck Grassley, the top Republican on the Judiciary Committee, who has been an advocate for cameras in the high court, asked Judge Jackson whether she would support cameras in the court.
On another subject, kind of personal to me over a long period of time and about half of this committee, but it's a controversial issue even within this committee. I favor allowing Supreme Court hearings to be televised. What's your view on this? How would you feel about cameras in the courtroom, which about 45 of our states allow?
Well, Senator, I would want to discuss with the other justices their views and understand all of the various potential issues related to cameras in the courtroom before I took a position on it.
I think that's a fair answer at this point.
Throughout C-SPAN's history, we have also pushed for greater public access to the federal government, requesting more television and audio access to the Supreme Court. Follow the debate, along with all things Supreme Court, on our website, cspan.org/Supreme Court. And of course, you can watch gavel-to-gavel coverage of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's confirmation hearing in its entirety on our website, cspan.org, or the free mobile video app, C-SPAN Now.